This is Bonnie Buckaroo of Lansing Online News Radio with a special show tonight on race in East Lansing, featuring my interview with co-host Bill Castanier. East Lansing, Michigan was one of the last places in the state to pass an open housing ordinance in the late 60s. Now that may seem surprising considering it has long been a college town. Local journalist Bill Castanier always wondered why. And he also especially wondered why Michigan State University President John Hanna did not show more leadership. When you look back at your life here in East Lansing, what have you seen personally, and how did you become engaged with the issue of black struggle here in the community? Because you have followed this for years. You've been a passionate supporter of this cause, one of the stronger white allies in the community in terms of being willing to stand up and say, no, that's, you know, this is wrong. Things must change. And I wonder where, if you know where that comes from.
It's interesting. It didn't come from Michigan State University. I mean, it added to it. But when I was a junior in high school in 1965, I had Dominican nuns who were all about social justice. They were strict in other ways, and you know, they were nuns. I mean, you gotta accept that. But at the time, we, our students, and we were juniors and seniors, and at the time, what was going on was this, right now, Selma, it was 50 years ago.
Yeah.
So the whole civil rights movement was in full stride, and these nuns decided that for somewhere around 4 months, starting in January of 65, that we would meet with another school in a nearby community that was all black. We would meet with their a representative group of their juniors and seniors, and I think we were honor students, frankly. I think, and the idea was we each need to know the other. That's basically all we went into it with.
This was 65.
Yeah, 65. That to me has meant more to me, and I have a photograph of that event at home. That's meant more to me in many ways than I can repeat. There's an interesting anecdote about how dumb we all were. One of the students from my class, the first question this guy asks is, why do you people drive such big cars?
Oh, wow.
And I thought, this is going to end right now. This is over. it's like, oh, my God, how embarrassing. But it proved to be the best question he could ask, because somebody from our partner school that was all black stood up and said, because you won't let us buy houses.
Oh, of course, because where else can you put your money?
It diffused the whole thing, and we became close friends. The group of us, we started doing things together. We created a lot of ruckus between the two schools because it was just fun. It was a fun time, and I don't think we ever realized, or at least I didn't realize until relatively recently, that was part of my commitment to civil rights. Those nuns went out of their way to make it happen.
That is wonderful, and I, to be honest about it, when I look at how there's been the resegregation of schools in the United mm-hmm. States, they're worse now than they were at the time Brown v. Board of Education. We need to be doing that again, don't we?
Oh, I think so. But the nuns had the ability to pull it off. No one said no to them. You know, parents would never say, you can't do that. That's wrong.
Today I don't know how you can do that.
And then just recently, it's like one of those light bulbs go on. Sister Drusty. Ellen Drusty? I forget. You know who I'm talking about? The sister, she's a Dominican nun, and she's the one that was arrested for all the anti-war activities and put in prison.
Oh.
She's the character that's on Orange is the New Black.
Oh,
The nun.
Yes.
She was one of the nuns at that other school.
You're kidding.
I had no idea.
Is that right?
And you can only surmise, because most of them are dead. I'd love to talk to Sister Drusty and ask her about it.
It's hard to remember how radical some of the nuns were. I mean, we knew the Father Berrigan, the Berrigan brothers.
Absolutely.
And they were quite radical. '60s was their era. The Catholic Church was really...
The social justice aspect of the Catholic Church was preeminent, and we lived it and didn't know it.
Right.
We belonged to SNCC.
Oh, did you really?
Our nuns had us join the student nun. And so when I told John Lewis that, he just was like, great, huh? What? Why would you do that? I said, because the nuns. He knew about the Dominican nuns because they were at the Selma March.
Wow.
I don't know if ours were. It's too late to ask them.
Right.
But you can look in the photographs and see their distinctive habit. They're right there. They walked in Selma.
I don't know of any schools that do that now.
I don't think so. And it seems kind of hokey, the way I tell it. But it wasn't.
No.
It really wasn't. It changed our lives.
Well, I was, and this is not a knock on the students who did it, but I was talking with the students from a few years ago from an affluent suburb in Detroit, and somebody donated to them more than, I think it was more than $10,000, mm-hmm. to do a special project. And what they decided to do as a social justice project was Darfur, which was a mm-hmm. big issue at the time. And I said, but if you really wanted to do social justice, these were kids from, I think, Rochester Hills, they should go down to Detroit and see what was happening with the loss of the automobile business and the decay in Detroit, yep. The ruin porn going on. It would have been a wonderful experience for them, and they would have seen firsthand. So for them to be reporting on international affairs when there was a disaster right down the road, that's what's so lacking, is that kind of sister school arrangement.
Yeah, it was close to us. I mean, wow. And we ran into these kids all during, you know, the school year, and It was an amazing experience. So then when I came to MSU, race was not an issue to me. It really wasn't an issue. It was just something else. But it came out of probably the peace movement, because MSU didn't really ever have a tremendously active civil rights movement. It got overtaken by the peace movement and the anti-draft movement.
Yeah.
But I do remember a commitment... and I know all this stuff sounds, in today's world, it sounds so strange to people, but I remember at a draft board hearing that I had to get a conscientious objector, I refused to fill out the paperwork because I just said I went to school. You know, there's kids all over this country that probably feel the same way I do, but they can't write that. So it was an elitist kind of thing, and I picked that up from an African-American I knew on campus very well, who said, you know who's over in Van Dyne, don't you? My brothers. You know, that's who it was, basically. We used black men in Vietnam, young black men.
Absolutely. I think the surprising thing now is we see that war has changed so much that they need fewer people, more drones, and we need high-tech people. So it's a totally different paradigm. Even the idea of bringing back the draft is not really feasible, because we don't have anything that these people would do.
They have enough troops.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have more than enough, really. They don't deploy them at all. So that's kind of how I got interested in it.
But when you came to MSU, one of the issues that really resonated and that you have continued to keep an eye out, and I guess this was in recent weeks an opportunity to really take a closer look at, were open housing issues related to what was going on in East Lansing. So at the same time, they were claiming the mantle. I mean, they had the Pigs and Freaks football game. They were getting a great press for being very progressive and very open-minded, even maybe in some ways more so than their counterparts in Ann Arbor, who were... you know, equally mm-hmm. engaged in anti-war activities, but maybe, I mean, it was surprising. MSU was very active in those things.
Oh, yeah.
But they were not very good on race. I mean,
absolutely not. East Lansing virtually had no African Americans living in that community. A handful would be a lot. It wasn't until 1962 that there was a black teacher at East Lansing. But that black teacher could not live in East Lansing.
So that teacher taught at East Lansing High School?
Yeah, taught in the middle school, and then later taught at the high school, but they could not live there.
Wow.
Open housing basically was the issue about keeping out blacks, Jewish, and they called them Mongoloids at the time.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that was the purpose of open housing, and East Lansing was not alone. I mean, Ann Arbor was like that. Any white strong white community was like that. The South was actually more integrated than the North.
Well, that's true, yeah, in some communities like that. And
yeah, it was, and what I tried to do is I realized doing research over the past couple of years on other stories, one on SDS, Students for Democratic Society, and then another story I worked on Morrill Hall.
What?
The Morrill Hall is the most recent one, and just triggered it. What happened is I was looking for the practices that women had to follow during Morrill Hall era, which was at the turn of the 1900s. And what I discovered in another story was that two women had been kicked out from MSU for violating hours in 1965 because they had been arrested for civil rights demonstrations.
Really?
And so that kept in the back of my mind, 65, when it got to be closer, 50 years, I decided to go back and look at it. And I was happy I did, because I certainly learned a lot about this issue. I talked to more than probably 30 people, at least 30. I spent many weeks doing research at both the MSU archives and also the downtown Lansing Library and the State of Michigan Library, looking at newspapers in those two, the library downtown and the Lansing Library. But also then I spent quite a bit of time in the MSU archives looking at John Hanna's papers. All of Hanna's, and I say all with quotes around it, Hanna's papers are at the MSU archives, and you can find some amazingly interesting things in there.
Are they like Hillary's emails? Were they sanitized?
Yeah, I believe they were. We're in odd ways, because you take a look at his record on the Vietnam War, there is so much in there that is so condemning, and I'm
really
kind of wondering what they took out, if anything.
What could be worse?
Because it was bad. But you look at the open housing records, and there's substantial amount on it, but there's no smoking gun, there's very little specifics about what he did or didn't do, what he wanted to do, what his thought patterns were. But one of the things I found that I thought would be very important to be in his records were his appointment calendars.
Oh.
There are none for the, how many years he was president, 30?
Wow.
There's no records on who he met with.
Was he president that long?
I don't know if it was 30, but it's more than 25.
Whoa.
It was 49 to 69.
Wow. From leaving a mark.
Oh, yeah, and he did. He did amazing things. He built that university up from what was considered a cow college.
Right.
To
Moo U.
I mean, he created a university unlike, you know, it's pretty much unparalleled. And
it is a world-class university.
It absolutely is, especially in the, you know, in the shadow of U of M, who was fighting him every inch of the way. So he did a lot. He was seen as a champion for civil rights.
That's the interesting part.
And that bothered me after I got into this, because he was the head of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission,
mm-hmm.
and he was appointed under three presidents. He would go around the country holding these very important hearings. They had no legal power, but he'd hold hearings in like Selma, Alabama, or Jacksonville, Mississippi, or...
That alone was pretty brave.
Yeah, and they were talking about similar issues, what was going on here in East Lansing. And what I kind of identified, what I thought was an anomaly, is he did not stand up and say at any time in East Lansing, you've got to have open housing for my professors and students. Never did that.
Well, you and I went to the session that was held out there in East Lansing
mm-hmm.
a few months ago, and we heard stories from people who were profs at MSU trying to buy a house here. You know, they'd come in, they would want to move their family here, and then they would find out that nobody would allow them to buy.
Right, and that's how I start the story, by talking about Clarence Underwood coming from Fayetteville, North Carolina. He packs his wife and his daughter on a train. They come, spend all day basically getting here. They get to Lansing about early afternoon. He gets off the train, he buys a Lansing State Journal, starts going through it and making phone calls about renting a house in East Lansing. And every call, the answer was the same: we don't rent to Negroes.
Mm.
And I mean, this man had seen racism. He grew up in the South.
Right.
So it wasn't, what was shocking to him is he didn't realize it was in the North.
Well, that was the shocker, wasn't it?
He had no clue. And he now is funny about it, but I'm sure that day when he couldn't find any place to live in East Lansing, and he's running out of time because he got out of the service, his discharge got screwed up, so he got out late, so he wasn't able to get married housing. See, if a black was going to MSU, they stayed in married housing if they're married. Or the dorms. The dorms were desegregated. Hanna did that. So he's here in the city, no place to live. He's got a young baby, a wife. He leaves them at the train station down on Michigan Avenue and starts walking around downtown Lansing looking for what he calls where blacks live.
Right.
That's the only thing he can figure out to do. 4 hours later, he finally runs into a black man, stops him and asks him. And the guy says, yeah, I got a room I can rent you. So that's how I start the story. And what Clarence said is he had the impression that MSU, East Lansing, was totally segregated. It was a different world up here because he had seen MSU...
Totally integrated.
Yes.
He thought it was integrated.
Totally integrated. He'd seen MSU football players during the Rose Bowl, and they had many, many players that were black on the team. And he just assumed that anyone that would let black players play football on a university team must be wide open. Poor Clarence. He laughs about it today, but he wanted to get back on the train, he said, and go home. It was so awful at that time.
Had to be completely disillusioned.
I can't imagine.
Now, we heard from the football player, the Capital Area District Library, the Historical Society of Greater Lansing brings in, and we hear the stories about that Rose Bowl team.
Right, and they did desegregate football. They did desegregate the dormitory, but MSU never got involved in the desegregation of East Lansing housing, which really started in 63. And it started because of the measure of one pastor at Edgewood United Church. He was from the South. He was an ardent activist for social justice. And he set up a committee that led to the East Lansing City, or the East Lansing City Council, establishing the Human Relations Commission. Their goal, their only goal, was to create an open housing ordinance.
Yeah.
And by 64, they had agreed on one and passed it to East Lansing City Council, but it sat for 4 years until 68.
And do we know why it sat?
No, you really can't dig that out. And everything I read, I mean, you can make assumptions. The realty community was very, very strong.
I see. There was a black realty company in Lansing, right? And they were mostly, if you were African American and you came here, you were directed to them?
Absolutely. You were directed to certain neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And they were either, from what I was able to determine from the research, is they were either on the far west side of Lansing, right off the river, and it was about two streets, mostly St. Joe and Main Street, where African Americans live. And it's right now it's where I-496 runs through. So they were moved later. And then there was pockets of them right outside East Lansing over by Max Bar, right by Frando, really substandard housing over there. That's generally where they're located.
That was kind of the flats. And was that in the floodplain?
That was the floodplain, yeah.
Right by Francis Street?
Yes, you know exactly where it is. And somebody asked me, well, how did they determine where black neighborhoods were? I said, well, it wasn't hard. It was, remember the other side of the tracks? They
right.
looked for substandard housing, or it was next to a factory, or, you know.
Or it would flood.
No one wanted to live. It's pretty
Look at the Ninth Ward in New Orleans, where all the deaths were, because it was in the low the bottom land, where it floods whenever there's a problem. That is really sad. I mean, it's just such a sad time.
That was the way it is. And then Clarence went to MSU, got his bachelor's and master's degree, and then he got the job in East Lansing. And he couldn't find a house then either. And what happened was a member of the Edgewood United Church came up to him and said, I got a house I can sell you on a land contract.
Mm.
So he sold him a house on a land contract, and I found out that Clarence was not the first black professor or black person to live in that house. There was a previous a black professor that lived there, and he went on to become the first black on the Federal Reserve Board.
Oh, wow.
I mean, this guy was big time.
I guess.
He only stayed 3 years at MSU. But that house was right across the street from Edgewood United Church on Beach Street, and obviously they were using it for that purpose, to try to break the color barrier here in East Lansing.
Now, wasn't it in the deeds that you couldn't...
Absolutely. There was the deeds, and I have one in my house that says no Caucasians. Or no, only Caucasians, no blacks, Jews, Mongoloids. Those were typical, and the reason that happened is in 1926, the Supreme Court struck down these exclusions, which were then, at that time, a government for a whole governmental unity. They said you couldn't do that anymore. So what the realtors did, and this was a realtor thing, was got together and decided we would have these covenants. And it was a private covenant between the owner and who the person sold it to. But those covenants are like...
They've got legal power.
They have the right of law. You could lose your home.
Oh.
You know, that's...
Oh, that's a penalty.
Yeah, so that was one of the reasons that this whole color barrier was forced on people, mostly through boards of realtors around the United States. And boards of realtors were very powerful. Back in the 60s and 50s, real very powerful.
Well, I grew up in Cleveland, and the practice there was, for example, a community of very expensive homes called Bratnall. And what there was, there was a policy of blockbusting. And what it meant was that the realtors would come into a neighborhood that was a white neighborhood, and they would persuade one person to sell. They'd give them a premium on the sale, if necessary, to get that person in order to move a black family in, and then go around the neighborhood and panic everybody that you had to get now because property value is going to drop. You better sell now. And they made money on what was called the churn. It was the idea that because the properties were all moving, you know, everybody in the house would bail out in that community as the prices continued to plummet. When you have that many properties coming on the market, the price goes down. And they made money on the churn, you know, and that was a traditional practice. Now, we didn't see actual blockbusting here, did we?
Yes, we did.
Oh, we did see blockbusting.
Not in East Lansing. That never happened in East Lansing, but it happened in Lansing.
Oh, okay.
When I-496 came through, blocks were busted because 900 black families had to go somewhere.
Oh.
And that was used as the blockbusting technique then.
I see.
So that, in a strange way, segregated Lansing. Or desegregated Lansing, I-496. Blacks, 900 family homes were destroyed.
Wow.
And there were another 300 or more behind the state capitol that were destroyed for buildings that would come later. So blockbusting did happen. It happened a little later in Lansing, not as early as, say, Detroit or maybe Cleveland and that. The other thing that happened...
Yeah, but you're talking about that that integrated, right?
Yeah.
Now, see, blockbusting was used to
odd?
Segregate.
Isn't that odd here? I mean, it created white flight.
But right,
some
exactly.
White stayed.
Yeah.
It didn't totally make all black neighborhoods, but it changed the whole west side of Lansing.
Oh, I see.
Because they had to move somewhere. Hmm. The other thing that was used, and wasn't able to write about this either, it's because you only got 2,500 words, was the FHA rules and regulations... and practices basically required not the adjusters, what are the people that go out and evaluate
assessors
to indicate and downgrade homes that had blacks in them or black
yes.
neighbors.
Yeah,
and it was a part of our public policy.
Right,
it goes back to the Roosevelt era, and it was a deal that Roosevelt cut in order to get the New Deal passed. I just like. So it continued well through the 70s, those strange things, even after the open housing law passed in the United States.
You're listening to LCC Radio, WLNZ 89.7 here in Lansing, Michigan. We're talking with Bill Castanier tonight about the recent article that he published in City Pulse on open housing in the East Lansing area, and then also delving into some history related to what happened in Lansing. So really there were two separate kinds of community issues going on at the same time. The sort of issues in Lansing were different than the ones.
Oh, absolutely. And Lansing didn't have the same problems that East Lansing did. They were a somewhat integrated community.
I see.
And that probably happened to more urban areas. I mean, East Lansing
yeah.
at that time was almost a suburb.
Right. And it was much smaller, I'm assuming.
It hardly made it to Hagedorn.
Mm.
I mean, Hagedorn was almost a dirt road in the mm-hmm. 60s. It was kind of surprising how much it burst out after that. But what all this led up to was in 1965, a group of students, the NAACP, formed a group that said, we've got to do something. It became part of that whole student activism. And they began agitating on campus. Then they decided that their focus had to be East Lansing City Council, because open housing ordinance was going nowhere. So, I'll make this brief, but what they did is they started holding demonstrations at City Hall in East Lansing. The first demonstration they held, there was 70 students, and they did a peaceful sit-down, and they did it in the chambers of City Council meeting rooms on the second floor of City Hall.
Hmm.
And they weren't arrested. They were carried out. Four police officers to one man, and the women were loaded on stretchers and carried out. Yeah, it was sort of quaint, right?
It's kind of,
it was very quaint.
It's charming, actually.
It was very charming. It's just because, you know, a couple years later, that wasn't the case. It didn't matter what and who what your,
dragged you away
what your gender was.
Yeah.
So the first one, 70 of them were taken outside, deposited on the sidewalk, and the students got up and marched back to campus singing We Shall Overcome. And this was in the first week of May of 1965.
Now, were these all black students, or
no,
were these black
no, it was
and
mixed.
White students?
About a third were black.
About a third were black.
Very tidily dressed. Some had sport coats, suits, that kind of thing. Very well behaved, and they were trained in nonviolence, so they didn't do anything violent. They didn't resist. A week later, they had a march that didn't go off, but they met with some of the officials in the city and things, and they didn't get any satisfaction. And then they went to John Hanna and asked John Hanna if he would support open housing. He basically had a week, I support open housing, but what they wanted him to do was sign a petition signed by 119 professors in favor of open housing, and he would not do that.
So he wouldn't sign the petition?
He wouldn't sign it.
But he would. Was he vocal to them?
He was weak.
He was
very weak.
didn't go on public media in the community.
No,
or?
No. And then what happens is they meet with the mayor of East Lansing, they being the students, and there were some faculty members there, but none of the faculty members were in the arrests. Because what happened is the next day, they meet at night with the mayor of East Lansing, Gordon Thomas, who was a professor at MSU, also of communication. And they meet with him outside Beaumont Tower. And it's about 11 p.m. And they don't get satisfaction from him. So what they do is they march to City Hall in East Lansing, and they sit down on Abbott, right in front of it. About 60, 70 students sit down. And they refuse to move. They are not going anywhere. So this time, the mayor comes out and says they're trespassing, and about 70 police officers move in. They weren't as gentle with the men. They dragged them by their heels. The women, they still put on stretchers. These individuals were arrested and charged. John Hanno had walked over from Call's house on campus where he lived, and what he was doing is just probably just like anyone else, standing in the crowd observing, but when a state news reporter saw him and asked him what he thought, he says, well, I think East Lansing was very restrained. I would have done something sooner than that, and then went back to on campus. So he was kind of flippant with this. So these students get arrested. They get hauled by MSU buses to Ingham County Jail. That got people going, too, because that obviously said somebody had asked to have these buses, because there was no way at that time to get that many people that far. I mean, it was 60 people.
Had to be with Hannah's assent.
Oh, absolutely. No one would have given that permission of using campus buses without him saying okay. So they spent overnight in Ingham County. Next day, they're hauled back with East Lansing buses again, and a couple of the students plead guilty, pay fines, but the rest of them, unified front, they're not going to do a thing. You're going to have to take us to trial. So a community group paid bail, got them out. Bob Green was one of them. The Truman Morrison, the pastor, John Dooley, they took up donations and paid for it.
Wow, those are names that resonate.
Yeah. And so this dragged on then for several years, because I think no one really wanted to push it. And ultimately, charges were dropped against most students. A couple students were singled out.
Were these misdemeanor or felony?
These were misdemeanors,
okay.
Yeah. And the fines were $7, $8 or something. Mm. So any student could have paid these fines. This was not as serious.
It was a matter of principle.
It was a matter of principle, and they believed it and would not. And I think East Lansing was surprised about that, because then all of a sudden you've got 60 people approximately you got to take to trial.
Yeah, and that's quite a burden.
Oh, very much. So they consolidated the cases.
Plus, you're on the wrong side of history.
Oh, my gosh, were they on the wrong side of history. And at the time, Hannah's lieutenants, I call them, because that's how I saw them, they were his vice presidents, were all advising him, this is a communist plot.
Oh,
I mean, they got caught up in that anti-communist stuff with this here in East Lansing.
We see that undercurrent so often in that whole... So I was reading about
And you can see it in
the
archives.
Yes, you do.
They didn't try to hide that at all. It was there.
Obama alluded to it in the summer speech that it was supposedly always the outside agitators.
Yep. Well, and this is kind of funny. James Farmer, who was the head of, he would have been the head of SNCC then, I think. Anyway, he came in town exactly the same time. So they were connected to the National Civil Rights Movement, because he left Selma to come into East Lansing to talk to students. And he told them that responding to the agitator concept, he says, you know what an agitator is? It's that washer that goes round and round and gets rid of all the dirt. He pointed his finger at the real estate professionals in town that were keeping this from happening. He was very direct about it. And as you know, Bob Green, who was a professor on campus at the time, very, very much an activist, outspoken. He became one of Martin Luther King's lieutenants. They became very close friends. And Bob Green tells the story about how Walter Neller, a local realtor, just came to his house unannounced and started arguing with him about why does a black man, he called him a pup, which really offended Green. And he said, why would you want to live? Why don't you want to live with your own kind?
Right.
And he became very agitated, and Green said he had to basically show him out. And there's a couple other people that tell that same story. a local lawyer in the town who was on the Human Resources Commission, Mary Sharp, and we've interviewed her daughter here. So it's Mary Sharp is a, her daughter's a doctor. This Mary Sharp, who was on the commission at the time, was a lawyer. And Mary Sharp, the doctor, told me that her mother received many, many nasty phone calls about this because she was in support of open housing and threats. And she said that her father, who was a doctor, was approached after one of his surgeries in downtown Lansing, and he said he was approached, and another doctor said to him, "Why can't you keep your wife in control?" I mean, you really can't pick it out except in these anecdotal cases, but this had to be incredibly divisive in this community at the time. Just under the radar.
Right.
It could have, and why it didn't become another very nasty outbreak, I attribute it to, it was late in May. These things were going on late in May, the arrest and the demonstrations, and what happened? There was Memorial Day weekend, students are gone.
Oh.
Then they came back and had finals and left for the summer. By the time they came back in the fall of 66, the movement had moved toward anti-war and anti-draft. It happened that quickly. So the civil rights movement wasn't ever a big issue here. It's still a big deal because they didn't have open housing until 68.
The last community in the state or second to last?
It was close. 4 days before the passage, or the, not the passage, but 4 days before the Fair Housing Act took effect, East Lansing did a symbolic vote and said yes.
Oh.
And it was 4 days after Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Wow.
And East Lansing went through some small riots, well, pretty significant riots, I guess, because of the assassination.
Yeah.
So I think it was more symbolic than anything. It just do it, get it over with. We got it on the record. But yeah, they were one of the last communities in the state to do it. And it still seems illogical to me. But I think it gets down to, I'm for civil rights, but I don't want them living next to me. I mean, it was about the cost of their house would go down and things like, you know.
All those pragmatic things about the value of their homes, yeah. Et cetera, that were masking what it really is. It's the difference between individual and institutional racism.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what it is. And that was sort of the cutting edge. And one of the funnier and sadder things I remember about this is the local realtor board kind of believed they were helping the issue, and they formed a committee, and they came to the Human Relations Commission in one of their first meetings and presented this 13-point plan that would, here's what we'd see to have open housing in East Lansing. There wasn't one thing in that 13-point plan that said we should have open housing at all.
Uh-huh.
And so the chairman of the commission, his name was H.C. Tian, is a Chinese doctor in town, a psychiatrist. He accepted their 13-point plan, absolutely outraged, and ripped it up right in front of him. Mm. That was probably not the smoothest move, because he got replaced on the board.
Wow.
But so it didn't go well from the start.
Yeah.
I mean, both sides were a little outrageous in some of their activities, but I can understand what he did, because it was just an awful statement of nothing, frankly. Nowhere in there did it say open housing in East Lansing. It was all these little things. People should have the right to sell their house to them when they wish, you know, those kinds of things.
You have to say what it is.
And it was a disaster on both sides, though, but that possibly delayed it. I mean, it just never happened.
This is LCC Radio, WLNZ 89.7 here in Lansing, Michigan. We're talking with Bill Castanier about racial history here in the community, and at the time that this was going on, or actually a little earlier, in 1961, I was taking a class from Dr. Joseph Smith at Jackson High School. He was a Harvard-trained English teacher, and one of the things that I knew was a real passion of Dr. Smith's was jazz. And there was a small club in Jackson at the time that had jazz musicians, because Jackson was always sort of on the line between Detroit and Chicago. So sometimes as the musicians would travel from one city to another when they had gigs, they would stop off and play in Jackson. And I remember the pain in his eyes. I mean, he was probably one of the finest teachers I've ever had. And again, as we've talked, extraordinarily dignified, showed up every day in a suit and tie, very, very formal. But written into his contract and no one else's was that he was not allowed to go to the jazz club in town. And I think it, he said it was because there were white, primarily white patrons, and they didn't want apparently too many black patrons in the club because they felt that it would hurt business. And it's that kind of economic argument that was often used that I think was just so disastrous in that era. There were all these economic reasons why people couldn't upset the apple cart. One of the things I think that you've discovered over time was you've talked extensively with Dave Hollister, former mayor of the city of Lansing, and a lot of his personal story kind of tells you where a lot of, I think, white people got radicalized. And in his story in particular, he was sort of instrumental in some of these issues. He spoke movingly at that meeting in East Lansing.
Right, and I didn't know this until I talked to him. This go-around, he was in a small community nearby Lansing, teaching. He'd already graduated from MSU. He was a teacher. And he understood that his students knew nothing about race. It was an all-white community. He had friends in Flint, so he brought in the head of, I think, the Flint Urban League to speak, who was black, and his son came along with him. And Dave said, what happened is the kids were so interested in listening to this man and his son speak that they stayed on for the next class. That class stayed on for the next class. That class stayed on for the next class. And he said they decided to move to the auditorium. Well, when they did that...
When was this?
It would have been 2 years, it had been 62.
Oh.
So when they did that, the principal came out and said, what's going on here? Why are you doing this? And he told them. And come to then after that semester, the next semester, they wanted to change all the rules that every teacher had to submit a curriculum, what they were going to do, basically, and it had to be approved. So six teachers walked out.
Really?
Including Dave Hollister. They just left their jobs.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing, including a teacher who ended up being a state representative with David.
Wow.
His last name is Spaniola, so he'd been representative of Spaniola, but he and David and four others walked out. And Dave didn't have anything to do then. I mean, he was married, had a kid. So he went back to school at MSU, was getting his master's, and he had the opportunity, along with 4,000 other people, to listen to Martin Luther King come to campus to talk about race. And this was just before these events happened, in 65.
Yeah.
It was in February 11th of 65, Martin Luther King came to campus. And John Dooley, who is a campus pastor and activist, was very, very involved, as well as Bob Green, in getting MLK to come here. And Dave saw him, and he was so moved by him, he said, I knew I had to do something. So he went down and met him. He went down the back way and out and had a conversation with him. And Dave was one of the first MSU students to sign up then to go to the South to teach at Rust, not to teach at Rust College, to advise at Rust College. Rust College was in jeopardy of losing their certification, accreditation, because they didn't meet certain standards. So MSU students and MSU professors went down there to help them get their accreditation. And Dave went down for two summers. Most of these students, except Dave wasn't, he wasn't from out of state, were from out of state. But they were extremely committed to the civil rights movement. And that's part of civil rights lore. Anyone that knows anything about civil rights knows what MSU did at Rust College.
So MSU really helped save that Rust College.
Yeah, at the same time, John Hanna didn't stand up at home. That's what bugged me about the whole story. And I've not been able to get any kind of insight into what it was.
Is there no chatter about that? In other words,
there's some chatter that he was friends with realtors, but he couldn't prove it.
Right.
And he didn't want to upset the apple cart.
The civil rights movement really, and I think the anti-war movement in this culture, drew a line and said you're either a stand-up person or you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't good enough to be a good guy out of town. You know what I mean? Serving a national role is important, doing those things, but you really had to walk the walk in order to justify.
Seems to me.
Yeah.
This is the one that counted.
Right.
This is the one that mattered. The others were important, yes, but the one that mattered was to advocate for open housing in your adjacent community, and he never would do it.
I mean, I think of people like, I mean, the heroine for me in that era was Viola Liuzzo out of Detroit. Who went down south. I mean, she left a family with five kids and said, she was just so moved by what was happening with the Freedom Summers, that she went down there and she lost her life.
Right.
Driving, you know.
On Bloody Sunday, yeah. driving people back from Montgomery to Selma.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a Detroiter, and the head of the FBI the next day said she was a communist sympathizer.
Of course, comp sim.
It was like, what? See, that was always the answer.
And sadly, my father was a racist and was quick to vilify her. Why would a woman leave her family?
White woman.
Why would she go down there?
They
turned it into something sexual.
Yep, they did.
Yeah.
And she was just a dedicated person.
Yeah.
I think she had been
influenced by the nuns, if I remember.
She was. She's Catholic, yeah.
Yeah.
There was just something about her going down there, and a lot of people went down there. Another white minister was one of the martyrs, Jim Reeb. He was... the day after the first march, which was March 7th, I think it was, he was beaten severely and died. Along with, I think it was James Jackson that kind of triggered the whole marches, because he was killed a week before. So there's three martyrs of Selma. It was interesting. And we come back home here, and students are still doing panty raids and going to Saugatuck. And there's a small cadre of 100 or so students who believe that this is wrong.
Yeah.
And they tried to make a stand.
And it is. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, for many of the students in that era, life went on, and, you know,
absolutely.
There was this dedicated band.
Yeah, absolutely.
Many of them did go into politics after that.
Many of them went into politics. Many of them went into university work.
Yeah.
But they still, I think, I've talked to many of them that went south to Rust, this is for a different story, and they were amazing young people, and they were now amazing adults. I mean, they're presidents of universities, or, you know, they're at Harvard and in charge of graduate education. They did something with their life.
Seeing the president and his wife and his two daughters there marching in Selma on the weekend was really powerful for me. I think it should have been powerful for everyone, because it was just a reminder of the heroics of the era, and that the good guys won. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
one of the few...
it doesn't always happen that way.
No, absolutely not. It doesn't happen.
It could have gone the other way.
Easily. And it still could.
I saw that there was commentary today criticizing the president for talking about the Voting Rights Act as part of the speech. What else would you talk about? That's what Selma was all about.
Whoa. Are you going to talk about picking up garbage?
Oh,
what's he going to talk about?
So
that was that's what the whole purpose of Selma. It would have been wrong not to talk about voting rights.
Yeah.
It was all about the right to vote.
I know. And he's talking about contemporaneous problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And
absolutely.
I tend to agree.
No kidding.
I mean, anytime you try to limit on how people can vote and who can vote and why they can vote, there's something wrong with that.
Well, we have some real stand-up people from the community. Hollister is one. I mean, we still have... When we went to that meeting out there in East Lansing a few months ago, there were a lot of the people from that era who were sharing stories, and it was pretty powerful.
They're the last.
Yeah.
Like John Lewis is the last of the big six that spoke out in the march in Washington, but they're the last. The other night, I was kind of happy I turned on a old TV special on PBS on Peter, Paul, and Mary, who became sort of the heart of the movement through their music, because I don't know if they showed it on kind of the retrospective of the march to Montgomery, but they were on the steps of the Montgomery courthouse playing when the marchers came in.
Wow.
And
Peter Yarrow was here last Friday.
Yeah, Peter Yarrow was here last Friday, and Noel Paul Stuckey went to MSU for 3 years.
Oh, I didn't know
before
that.
He dropped out to go to the Village.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, he came out of a white community, Birmingham, Michigan, and he became one of the staunch supporters of the Civil Rights Movement.
Well, it is definitely that we're glad to see that there's some real stand-up people in the community. This has been quite an evening, capturing an important element of Michigan State University history, East Lansing history, and Lansing history. We hope that you will join us next Monday night. This is Lansing Online News Radio with Bonnie Buckaroo and Bill Castanier. You've been listening to LCC Radio, WLNZ 89.7 here in Lansing, Michigan. Remember to tune in next Monday night at 7 p.m. See you then.